Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck Knicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. How's it going? Where are we at? I know, it's terrible and beautiful at the same time, and that is the way life is. I hope you're kind of able to focus on having a holiday this week. I hope that happens for you. I hope it's a good one and not a horrible one. I'll try to broadcast my yearly broadcast from down in Florida, where I will be doing a solo cook-off for a smaller group this year. It's the first time I've been down there since my aunt passed away a few months ago, and it's going to be a little heavy, but that's what life is. Life is heavy. You know, it comes and goes, but as you get on with it, it comes more than goes. But then eventually it just fucking goes. I hope you're all right. I'm a little loopy. I just got back from Denver. I did four shows. And man, maybe I'm getting too old for this shit. I don't know. Maybe I put too much of myself into it. I can't tell. All I know is I did four shows and I am wasted. I love going to Denver. I've been going for years. And I always loved that Downtown Comedy Works. And that's always where I've worked. And I think it's one of the best rooms in the country. But I got to be honest, that Comedy Works South, just as good. I don't know what it is with those places. The audiences are good, but there's something about the structures. And from what I understand, the woman who owns the place, Wendy, she designed both those rooms. And they are really some of the best rooms to do comedy in this country. And why do I need to say that? I'm just telling you, I enjoyed it. I got real work done. Taika Waititi is on the show today. I talked to him. He's a filmmaker, actor, and comedian. He won an Oscar for Jojo Rabbit. He directed the last two Thor movies. He's the executive producer of the series What We Do in the Shadows, Reservation Dogs, and Our Flag Means Death. His new film is called Next Goal Wins, and he's a fucking genius. I watched all his shit before I talked to him. I'd seen some of it, and I watched some of it again. I watched some of it for the first time, and that guy is an auteur of the highest order. Has a point of view, has a vibe to his movies, has a unique approach to comedy, is a very funny actor, works tremendously well with kids. It's just brilliant. And him and Sterling Harjo, who we talk about, are just amazing. There is a way of capturing the native way of life, Taika from New Zealand and Sterling here in Oklahoma, where you can just kind of create the tone of the life that they live, and it's a different tone than the rest of us live, and it's got its own kind of groove and its own humor and its own heart, and it's just amazing. And it runs through almost all of Taika's movies, including this new one, Next Goal Wins. But I just was thrilled to talk to him, but even more thrilled to sort of have a reason to go back and watch some of those movies, because they're tremendous. I was fucking excited, but okay, I'll ramble about that in a minute. I'll be doing a live talk with Cliff Nesteroff about his new book, Outrageous, at the New York Public Library on Wednesday, November 29th. It's a free event, and you can go in person or watch the live stream. Go to nypl.org/events. My Los Angeles dates in December. I'm at Dynasty Typewriter on December 1st, 13th, 28th, The Elysian on December 6th, 15th, 22nd, and Largo on December 12th and January 9th. Then in 2024, I'm in San Diego at the Observatory North Park on Saturday, January 27th. A second show has just been added for that night. Those tickets will go on sale tomorrow, November 21st at 10 a.m. I'm in San Francisco at the Castro Theater on Saturday, February 3rd. On February 4th, Sunday, I'll be hosting a screening of McCabe and Mrs. Miller at the Roxy Theater right there around the corner from the Castro. You might check their website. I don't know exactly how they're going to be selling tickets. I'll be in Portland, Maine at the State Theater on Thursday, March 7th, Medford, Massachusetts, outside Boston at the Chevalier Theater on Friday, March 8th, Providence, Rhode Island at the Strand Theater on Saturday, March 9th, and Tarrytown, New York at the Tarrytown Music Hall on Sunday, March 10th. I'll be adding more dates for the fall. I will be coming to a city near you. This isn't the whole of the tour. If I survive, I will be adding more dates, so don't panic. Man, Denver got some records, Wax Tracks, got some records, a few. Didn't need them, got them. Sandy Bull record, Glenn Campbell and Bobby Gentry record, a Salem 66 record, a weird Herbie Hancock record. I feel like I got one other record. I don't remember what it was, but I got them. But here was the thing that was kind of funny. The last show, it was Saturday night, my opener, Georgia Comstock, who was very funny, killed. And I got up there and I was kind of trying to contract my, you know, reel in my brain. I knew right away it was going to be hands-on, and it was, I had to stay on top of it, but I was going to do what I was going to do. It went very well, but there was a guy right up front and his wife, and apparently they was not laughing, just looking at me, just sitting right up front, a big guy, couldn't get him to bust an expression at all. And that's a fucking nightmare. The rest of the fucking crowd is going with me. It's great, but he's just sitting there. And he's got this look on his face that was impenetrable. He wasn't mad. At some point, I made fun of him, and then I made fun of him again. And there was a younger woman sitting next to him, also not laughing, who he said was his daughter. So I figured it ran in the family. But then he said he was too much like me to laugh. I'm not sure I bought it, but I just had to adjust to that. And I got to be honest with you, it made me angry, and it gave me an edge for the whole show. It wasn't bad. I was able to go in and out of the vulnerable places, but yet with a little bite to it. But something that's never happened to me before was that, you know, I do the whole show, and at the very last bit, the guy didn't laugh once. And at the very last bit, he lets out the most awkward, ridiculous laugh that I believe was genuine, but it rose above all the other laughs and kind of, you know, took shape in the ether as a ridiculous noise. And at that moment, I said, thank God I didn't make you laugh the whole show, because there was no way we were going to get past that laugh as a crowd. Maybe he was self-conscious about it and he chose to hold it in. I doubt it, but boy, it was just one of those laughs where it was like, wow. And there was one there on Friday night too, but no one made light of it. And look, it's a natural thing, but sometimes they're so unique that you got to be careful, because the audience knows, like, that's a weird laugh and it's very noticeable. And then if you draw attention to it, then they do it more because they do it unconsciously. And then it becomes the fabric of your show. But the fact that this guy didn't laugh the whole show till the last bit and then laughed, and it was ridiculous and annoying and show-stopping, I've never been so grateful, and I've never misread a dude worse. I don't know what his story was, but I kept telling him, like, I'm going to get you, and thank God I did not. That's what I'm going to tell you. So, look, Taika Waititi is here. And I watched all his movies in order, even the ones I've seen. And it's just a genius filmography because he has a unique vision and he's hilarious. I watched Eagle versus Shark, Boy is another one. What We Do in the Shadows, Hunt for the Wilder People, which is beautiful. Thor Ragnarok, Jojo Rabbit. I watched Thor Love and Thunder. I watched his new one, The Next Goal Wins. And I was just stunned and amazed and moved at the kind of vibe of his movies, the vision of his movies. It's just, you know, no one really, there's something about, and it makes total sense that he produced Reservation Dogs with Sterling Harjo, because Sterling works with American natives and Taika comes from New Zealand natives. and the groove of native life and native spirit and native heart is it just threads through most all of his movies, and it's very similar to Sterling's, and it's just totally unique to me, and totally that when Taika does comedy, it's hilarious. So let me share this conversation I had with him, and I did want to mention up front that we are talking about Sterling Harjo right at the beginning here, who created Reservation Dogs with Taika. I think we just got into it. I think we actually got riffing, got talking off the mics and just got into it. But that's who we're referring to. This is me talking to Taika Waititi. Sometimes I wish I paid more attention in school, or in some cases, any attention at all. There are probably a lot of things I could have gotten more out of, like literature, and now it's probably not in the cards to go back to school and study the classics. But luckily for us, there's a new podcast called The Foxed Page that dives deep into the best books of all time. This is basically like the best possible college English class, but more relaxed and fun. No pressure of grades or needing to prepare something to say in class. It's only the books you want to read and know about, presented by best-selling author Kimberly Ford. Everything from Cormac McCarthy to Madame Bovary, from classics like Frankenstein to modern hits like Lessons in Chemistry. I love Ireland, but I missed the boat on James Joyce. The Foxed Page has a three-part series on Dubliners, and that's a pretty great starting point. Want to get the most out of what you read? The Foxed Page is for you. Get it now wherever you get your podcasts. And you shot this new movie 4 years ago?
Shot in 2000. This time 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Then the pandemic happened. There was a year of just doing nothing. I didn't look at the film. Then I did finish the film, and there was a strike, so no one wanted to do anything for, again, another year.
Yeah.
And so now it's out.
And when did you do the pirate thing?
2021, did the first season. Then
so that was after.
The second season was last year.
Yeah.
So that was after. After I shot this film.
Yeah.
What did I do? I did Thor.
Yeah.
Another Thor film.
Oh, you did the second Thor
after the new one? After I shot this one, while I was in post on this one. Then I did these TV shows. I shot the pirate one, and then I shot Time Bandits. With Jermaine.
Yeah.
And another TV show, Interior Chinatown.
And what is that one?
That's one based on a book by Charlie Yu.
Oh.
And it's a great kind of, it's about a kid who lives in Chinatown.
Yeah.
Who realizes that he's a background character in a police procedural, like CSI. And all the light, when the cops come in.
Is it a doc style?
It's a Wong Kar-wai film. It's a bit like Fallen Angels or Chungking Express, and it's got, yeah, so we're using all those old styles, but he lives in this town, and the style of the shooting when we're with him, it's all like handheld, real raw lighting, and then when the cops turn up, white cops turn up to investigate things. The lighting turns into studio lighting, and the camera goes on dollies, and it's all beautiful. And like he's like, "Why is everyone backlit? Why are these cops all backlit? Everyone looks beautiful."
And you came up with that device?
Charlie Yu, who wrote the book.
Yeah,
we came up with that idea together, that to change the lighting and to change the style.
Yeah.
Whenever the cops turn up, and then he starts being pulled into that world, and then suddenly he's like, "Oh my god, I'm lit so beautifully, everything around me." He starts being pulled into the white world of stardom.
But what was I'm friends with Sterling these days.
Mm.
He came out to my birthday party. That was very nice. And, I was in the last season of that thing. And what was the involvement? What was your involvement in that? And how did you kind of bring that? Because I think that, for me, is one of the best TV shows in the last 20, 30 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And how did that all come together?
So Sterling and I were in my kitchen in the house I was renting up in Laurel Canyon.
Oh, here. How'd you meet him, though?
I met him in 2004. four.
As a director at a director.
We were both directors. We had short films at Sundance.
So going back to your short film.
Yeah. So I had a short film there. He had his first short film at Sundance. Oh. We met up through a guy called Bird Running Water, who used to work at Sundance. He used to run the native program there, pulling indigenous filmmakers together. Sterling and I met and hit it off. We realized we had the exact same childhood and upbringing, but he was in Oklahoma and I was in New Zealand.
Interesting.
And we just became best mates. And for years, we've just been friends for so long.
Yeah.
And then about 3 or 4 years ago, we were in this house I was renting in Laurel Canyon, and we were just lamenting how our representation on screen is
as natives,
you know, when you talk to anyone about, you know, like, what's the first thing that comes to mind when you ask someone, you know, when you say the words Native American? It's always a guy on a horse, you know, shirtless,
feathers
and all the and paint and
making noises.
Yeah, and it's, which is crazy because, you know, natives around the world have been dressing contemporary clothes for longer than they were dressing like that on horses.
And so, of course.
And so we were like, we're never funny in things. We're never like, there's never anything. It's always, we're scouts and we're always like, you know, sitting on mountaintops talking to spirits and like, yeah.
But by the point you had this conversation, you had done Hunt for the Wilder People and you had sort of defined a new version of New Zealand native anyway.
Yeah, yeah. But we were talking mainly about American natives.
Yeah.
And so in the kitchen that night, it was like, you know, like we were just sitting around having a couple of beers and realized, you know, that we both wanted the same thing.
Right.
And we came up with this idea about like something set on the res. We named it Reservation Dogs that night. And we said, what about something called Res Dogs? And it's about these kids.
Yeah.
And like, this is the things they do. And we basically pitched the idea to each other.
Yeah.
And I had a deal with FX.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm going to call them up tomorrow.
Yeah.
I called them the next day and I said, we want to do the show. And FX are great. And they said, love it. We'll do it. We need this.
Yeah.
And it was like that easy. And
were you part of the original casting and everything?
Yeah, casting and the writing and the first thing. But then, and what they wanted originally was like, they were like, Taika, you have to direct it and this stuff. And I couldn't do it. Where was I? Oh, that's right. I was back in New Zealand in quarantine trying to take my kids back to New Zealand.
Yeah.
And I was supposed to direct it from a hotel room. Huh. And it was just ludicrous.
Over Zoom.
Huh. They'd carry like an iPad around and like, you know.
That's crazy.
So I could talk to the actors. Which was, not only was that ridiculous, but also it's not my culture. It's not my people. It's not my story, really. You know, I helped create the show, but that's just Sterling's world and it's set in his hometown. And so it was always, it always should have been him directing that. So he directed it and I didn't. And I just became a producer and sat back.
But it's interesting that show, because I'd never seen anything like that, because there's, like you said, there's the idea of what natives are, but there's also the universe of growing up like that, and that culture has an entirely different pace, timing, spirituality.
Yeah.
And so everything is all new. Even the, you know, just the timing of the humor.
Yeah.
And it's the same with your early movies. But like the one thing I noticed, because I kind of watched them all, I've seen ones in the past, but I watched them all in a line, is that you, and it's same with Sterling, and I imagine was part of why you guys are friends, is that you guys can run the weight of the world through kids.
Yeah.
And it's a way to make it universal and understandable, and the limitations are just the emotional range of children.
Yeah.
But the topics are all there.
But also, I think looking at things through a child's lens really highlights how ridiculous the grown-up world is and the shit that we do to each other and the things that we come up with. And like, even with Jojo Rabbit, you know, like the thing, like, when you look at the Nazis, right?
Right.
You look at like the shit that they put on their uniforms.
Yeah.
You know, they were a bunch of kids.
Yeah.
Like, immature kids who were like, this is what's cool. Lightning bolts and eagles and I want a skull and crossbones on my hat.
Yeah.
And like, you know, they were like literally, they thought, this will be scary.
So cool.
And this is so cool. Yeah. And like, they were grown-ups decorating their uniforms with a skull and crossbones. Yeah.
But I think like, even like, you know, Boy, which I think is kind of a masterpiece, and I don't know how out there that's gotten in terms of people seeing it. But I mean, that the father character that you play in that, because that mixture of a kid's sense of fantasy and belief that his father is this amazing person.
Yeah.
And then when the guy finally shows up and he's a buffoon.
He's a fucking loser.
But he's a clown.
Yeah.
You know, he's a loser, but he's endearing.
Yeah.
I mean, I could have made it, you know.
No, exactly. One thing, you know, I could have just made him just like your cliche, like, asshole dad.
Who's right.
Just, you know, but he is trying. He's right. Trying to be a cool dad. He wants to be loved.
Right.
And that's like, and I think most of those characters, and most villains, I think, want to be loved. They want to be liked. They want people to notice them.
Well,
and
there's a difference between
most villains.
Right. There's a difference between, like, you know, characterizing somebody as a heel and as somebody who's truly evil, right? So the doofus villain, you know, always has that immaturity, right? That you kind of, you empathize for him and you realize that he's limited.
Yeah.
And
it comes, and I think every villain, it all comes back to their parents.
Yeah.
I think it comes to dad, like my dad.
All the problems.
I'm trying to impress my dad. Trump is still trying to impress his dead dad.
I know. But that's like all the problems, whether it's trying to impress your dad or just that they wired you in a fucked up way.
Yeah.
And your entire life is just trying to get your needs met that will never be met.
Never. I'm still trying to impress my dead dad. I'm still, everything I do, I'll show you.
Really?
Yeah. Right.
What was that?
Look at me now.
Yeah. Go fuck yourself. Yeah. I won.
I'm better than you.
Well, my dad has lived long enough to realize that I'm better than him. But now he's losing his mind, so it doesn't stick.
Oh, shit.
You're like,
you remember this.
Yeah. I won, and now you don't even know it anymore.
Oh my God.
Kind of funny to see him kind of drift away. I just saw him.
Well, and boy, I played my dad, basically. My dad did bury a bag of money in a field and never found it again.
It's such a great comic device. Because initially in the movie, you don't think that you think he's bullshitting.
Yeah.
You know, and then there's just this journey of this kid trying to help him dig this thing up.
Yeah. But we used to go to help. Yeah, he buried a bag. He never found it. It's still somewhere in this field back in our community. One of these paddocks has got a bag of money buried in it.
A lot of money?
A lot of money.
that he got in a nefarious way?
Yeah. And it's sitting there. And that's all the discontinued banknotes, so it's probably worthless. But like, that's like $100,000 sitting in a field somewhere.
Really? Well, they got to make that right.
And
even if it's discontinued,
they got to make that right. If you find that bag,
you owe it. They owe it to you.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll take a little bit off the top, but they got to give you the money. So wait. So like, I don't know New Zealand, obviously, but is there a reservation type of culture?
No, we weren't put on reservations, but we have small, like, you know, our tribal lands that we've always stayed on. So we were never moved around because there's just not enough room. But a lot of that land for every tribe was taken. So in World War II, we went and fought for the crown.
Yeah.
And every non-Māori soldier who returned from the war was given a parcel of land, you know, to build a house, and that was their reward for fighting, except for the people who were from New Zealand. So none of us got any, and we came back, and it was just
like, what was the logic on that? So if you fought
racism?
Oh, yeah.
We're just like, you guys.
So the Maori that went to war but weren't indigenous to the country?
No, there were no Maori who went to war who weren't from New Zealand.
Yeah.
So every Maori went, and there were a lot of them,
came
back to nothing and came back to the government taking more of their land and giving it to white soldiers.
I see.
And so there's a lot of resentment. And from that, well, we're getting into it now, from that stemmed a huge amount of resentment that then trickled down to their children, which is my dad's generation.
Yeah.
And so my dad's generation grew up very resentful of their parents
who
fought in the war, but who came back, and then there was a lot of alcoholism, and there was like, they were like, how come we're just losers?
Yeah.
And we can't, like, you know, we don't have any land, we don't have any money.
Right.
We're not allowed to speak our language at school. And so my dad's generation rebelled against society and their parents and started, that's where all the gangs in New Zealand started, is around that time.
What kind of gangs? How did that manifest itself?
My dad was one of the founding members of a gang called Satan Slaves, which was a bike gang.
So that's really
in the movie. Which is still going today.
In the movie.
Yeah.
But in the movie, you portray them as not really an organized bunch.
Well, they were. But like in the movie, I wanted to sort of poke fun at people. Anyone could start a gang.
Sure,
you just need enough. You just need more friends.
So it was modeled on the Hells Angels?
The Slaves were modeled on the Hells Angels and Headhunters and all those gangs. And then
a lot of them.
And then another gang started called the Mongrel Mob, which is like a very big gang in New Zealand, and a lot of my family's in that. And they were not bikers, I think so. Late 60s and all through the 70s and 80s and up until today, there was just like, that was like a very big part of New Zealand society with these, and Māori and non-white people who needed something.
Right.
Starting gangs and creating their own world.
Were they like shooting and robbing?
Yeah, a lot of rumbles, a lot of big, crime.
So there was a competitive territorial element to it.
Yeah, they were always fighting each other and fighting the cops.
Did they have a business? Was it a shakedown business or was it like,
A little bit. That came later, that stuff. When they realized that they could actually make money.
Right, by terrorizing.
Yeah.
So this is what you grew up in. Did he do jail time?
My dad was, he was in jail when my mother met him.
Really? That was their romance?
Yeah.
How did that work?
She had a friend.
Yeah.
She had a friend who was giving books out to had a program going around
for prisoners.
Yeah, it's like, introducing them to different books.
Yeah.
She tagged along with this friend of hers and met this guy who looked like Omar Sharif in prison.
That
was my old man. And they hit it off, and then she sort of like was like, "Oh, wait for you, I guess." And then he got out. They got together. She sort of entered into that world of the gang, there's a middle class Jewish school teacher
from where?
Yeah, from New Zealand. Yeah,
her
family were originally
New
from Russia, but like she grew up and she was born and raised in Wellington in New Zealand. Then they got together, and then he went back, then she got pregnant. He went back to jail. He was in jail the day I was born.
Yeah.
And he was in and out most of his life. But that was sort of like, it's a very normal thing. When I think about it, it's like, it sounds actually like insane. But like, it was a very normal thing. And like, I think, look, for a lot of people growing up in poverty, that is a normal thing. You've always got a family member. It goes away. And
right.
Like, there's that uncle. But that uncle was my dad.
And now, in Boy, so that was your story in a way.
That was very much my story. We shot in my hometown. We shot in the house I grew up in. We shot at the school I went to. A lot of my family are in the film.
Yeah.
All the kids and my nephews and nieces.
Really?
Yeah. So that was... And every location in Boy is some I've lived.
Because like in that movie, I think it kind of sets the stage for, your sense of comedic balance and your sense of emotional balance to where... Even though there are moments in that film where the father is clearly pathologically selfish and abusive to his mother, you're the character playing you, but somehow or another you're able to ride a line to where the empathy doesn't drift really from that guy. So I imagine that whole movie was sort of a learning curve in terms of how you're going to have your point of view.
Yeah, and I think we'd had films like Once Were Warriors, which is a really great New Zealand film, but it's brutal to watch, and it's just one of, it's like Breaking the Waves. It's like, this is just relentless, and you're just like, man, I'm like, once every 10 years, maybe I'll watch this. But like, a great film, but like, I think, we, especially as Māori, we've got to change the way we tell our stories, and I just felt like, man, for all the fucked up shit that went on in my childhood, like fighting and just people being fucking stabbed and chopped up and all sorts of crazy shit.
Yeah.
There were really fun times. Like weirdly people just laughed their way through everything like made a lot of jokes around stuff and like, you know.
Just that, the process of digging holes.
Digging holes and like just make it, just really... Yeah, and there's something in some of the jokes, yeah, even in bad taste, but at least there was humor through that time. And that's what I feel like in my films. It's like if you can pull an audience in with humor, you know, just sort of lube them up and, yeah, and then deliver the message you want. That's, the, I think, the ultimate way of telling a story.
Of course. Yeah, that it's not essentially a comedy, you know, that it's a different, people don't know what to call it, but it's really just.
Yeah,
it's still a drama, really.
It's still a drama. My films, they always say, oh, he's a comedic director. Yeah, but my films are dramas with jokes.
Yeah, yeah. And with, you know, characters that are deep enough to be comedic characters without losing their humanity.
Yeah. There are great comedies, which are comedies, you know,
sure.
Which is just, you know, wall-to-wall jokes.
Yeah.
And like, but you don't care about anyone.
Yeah.
You don't care about the characters. Even when they have that moment where they're like, oh, and there's like a supposed to be some sort of.
Yeah, because they're not real. They're not founded in anything.
No, no. Well, you know they're going to go back to being ridiculous, and you know they're going to undercut that emotional scene with a joke at the end of it.
Right, and dismantle the scene.
Yeah.
And diminish it.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I realized the other day that, like, I would say two or three of Scorsese's heaviest movies are fucking comedies, really.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? I mean, Goodfellas is a comedy.
For sure.
Right? And Wolf of Wall Street is a
absolutely
totally a comedy. King of Comedy is a comedy.
It is a comedy.
But it's gnarly.
Yeah.
Right? And also in Boy, you kind of set the standard, in not unlike Reservation Dogs, of the impact of American pop culture. I mean, the whole thing in Boy is driven by Michael Jackson, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was what... Even as a native person in that country, that was like this thing.
Yeah.
Unavoidable.
We thought Bob Marley was from a tribe down the road when I was growing up. I didn't realize he wasn't from
New
Zealand.
Another gang?
Yeah. Because like, everyone looked like him. Like, everyone had dreads and like, listened to reggae. Like, New Zealand has the highest listenership of reggae per capita outside of Jamaica. And it's like the furthest away on earth that you can get.
It's
like an identity thing with like identifying with...
Yeah.
With people who were just minorities who, you know.
Different types of natives.
Yeah.
Was your dad, did he ever do a job or an art or what, anything?
He was an artist. So
he was
a painter and a sculptor and a carver and he was a brilliant, like, brilliant artist.
It's like the movie. Yeah.
He's exactly. Exactly like the movie. He wouldn't know what an outsider artist was, but that's what he was.
But he was in and out of your life, really.
In and out of my life.
And your mom was
always. My mother was always in my life.
And
I lived with her mostly, and then I would live up on the coast with my grandmother or my dad. You know,
dad's mother.
Yeah.
And was there Jewishness in the house?
Not really.
Yeah, yeah.
No. My mother's parents, they like joined the Communist Party when they were young when she was like born and stuff, and they were just sort of like that was the time. That
progressive
was the time
Jews.
Secular. They were like. You know, religious on the side.
Yeah, yeah. You identify, but you don't need
to
put the work in.
Lazy Jews.
Well, you know, you do it a little bit.
Yeah.
Enough to keep
when it counts.
keep your Jewishness because no matter.
Your Jewish card.
Yeah, exactly. And no matter how much you engage, you're still a Jew at the end.
So for sure.
If they come after
you. No matter how much you disengage, you're still Jewish.
Sure. So, but you started in stand-up, basically?
Yeah, I started in, well, my background is painting, so I started, you know,
painting.
I was painting pictures, and that's all I wanted to do.
Did you go to school for that?
I did a few, not a painting, not an art school.
Yeah.
But painted with a bunch of people and like.
So it was what you wanted to do?
It was what I wanted to do. My dad was a painter, so I was like, oh, I'm going to be like
that. Yeah.
And then, and so I did a lot of that probably until into my 30s.
Yeah.
I started getting into theater with very early on. My mother and my father, you know, which is one thing I really love about them, they never pressured me to do anything but art. They wanted me to do art. They wanted me to be.
Like, that's the
she
best.
She wanted me to be acting and to be writing and to be creative. My dad wanted the same, and I think would have been disappointed if I'd chosen another path. And so I was just only encouraged to do that. My mother was a school teacher, and she would, like, for punishment, she'd give me two options. You'd be grounded, or you can write an essay on this William Blake poem. And I was like, I'd rather be grounded. She says, nah, just read the poem and, like, tell me about it. And
well, it's funny, given those two people, that you know, if they were disciplinarian or forced you into something else, it wouldn't stick because you could just be like, look at you.
Yeah, totally, totally.
Well, that's great, though, that they made you do that.
It's fantastic. And I'm really thankful for that because growing up, there was just no other option. There was no other I didn't have a backup plan.
Right.
So, you know, so then I got into theater and did a lot of plays and stuff through my youth and through my 20s. And that's when I went to university, I met Jermaine and Brett. And we started writing plays together, and we put them on because no one else would hire us.
I got to be honest with you. Like, I never really locked into Flight of the Conchords, you know? But watching Jermaine in Eagle versus Shark and in What We Do in the Shadows, I'm like, holy shit, this guy's hilarious.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He is the funniest guy I know. He's the best writer I know. He's just one of the, yeah, he's one of the greats.
And who's Brett? Is he the other?
Brett, he's the other guy from Flight of the Conchords. Another brilliant guy.
But you guys were like a team or a improv or you know, sketches? Like,
you know, I'm not suggesting that we're the same as Monty Python, but they all met at university. It was that kind of vibe. We all worked together doing
short
different
films.
Little things, short films and little things together. And Wellington at the time was just a hive of creativity, and there were a lot of cool people and cool writers and cool artists coming out of there.
But did you do like Edinburgh or anything with those guys?
Yeah, Edinburgh. Yeah,
with
we did the Fringe, yeah, in August. Yeah, we went and did that. Me and Jermaine went and did that. Jermaine and Brett did that a couple of years. And they won the Perrier one year. And at that time, I was like just getting into interested in film.
Never solo stand-up or anything like that?
I just solo stand-up.
You did?
A lot. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, in New Zealand?
Not in Edinburgh, in New Zealand. And then various places, just like as a kind of off-the-cuff thing. But I did that. But then a lot of it was also like, you know, the sort of, when it was trendy to be doing anti-comedy, you know, which is like,
I can't.
And now when I think back about it, I'm like, fuck, this pisses me off.
Well, to me, I've met those guys and they're always kind of the same. You're like, so why don't you just suck it up and
just
do the work.
Just do the work. Totally. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, stop failing on purpose because you're too scared of actually not doing the work.
What was your act like?
It was like a lot of stand up, but with sort of more of a theatrical version of that. You know, I'd be telling a joke, and then the microphone would be turned down. Just go silent, and then my recorded thought would come over. Like, what am I doing? I hate this. I'm not good at this.
Right. Oh, that's funny.
Like talking. You know, like they're all watching me. I should have been a dancer. This is way easier than this. I can't even write a joke. You're a fraud. You're a fucking fraud. And then they might come up and be like, and that is what she said about that.
Funny. So almost a cinematic device already.
Yeah.
And when you did the short film that you met Sirwin during Sundance, that was what kind of put you on the map?
That was Two Cars, One Night, and that was the first short I did, and then it got nominated for an Oscar, which was lost, but it was the thing that made me feel like maybe I should continue doing this because it's, you know.
And your parents were thrilled?
Yeah, they were thrilled. My dad was like, well, you're really putting our name out there. That's good. And my mother,
Did he ever go like, well, you get any money?
Yeah, no. He had the money.
Oh, he did. Good.
Oh, yeah. He had the money. He had so much money, he could afford to bury it in places and never find it again.
And then the Eagle versus Shark was the first feature?
That was the first feature, yep.
And how do you feel about that, looking back on it?
I haven't seen it in so long.
Yeah.
So I made this short, Two Cars, One Night, which was sort of like Boy, and I made that, and then I wrote a script for Boy.
Right.
But I was very scared about making that as my first film because I didn't want to fuck that up. And so like I put that to the side, and then I wrote the script, Eagle vs. Shark, super fast, with my girlfriend at the time, Lauren, she and I basically just worked on the story. And then made this film very, very fast. And it was like I wanted to just get that out of the way. Just make a film
so
I'd done it, you know? And then I could, like, understand my limitations, what the problems could be, you know? And
what were they?
Well, I just realized, like, that you need more time than you think. And just understanding. Because I directed, like, three things.
Yeah.
Like, tiny little things. And so I needed to understand, like, what it was like to be shooting for this long and to edit an entire thing as well. And like so it was more like a test.
It was interesting because like what it reminded me of in terms of tone, because like very quickly after that with Boy, you definitely found an emotional place that was authentic. And with the characters in Eagle versus Shark, it was almost like a type of independent film at the time, like Napoleon Dynamite or something.
Yeah.
Where you have these you know, kind of peculiar, eccentric characters that have an emotional life, but it's limited. But because they're, you know, peculiar, you know, they kind of carry the movie, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and you kind of, yeah, because they're, in, you know, for lack of a better word, nerds.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
Who don't run the world, but you're in their world. You're willing to like give them a chance.
Yeah,
you know, like,
yeah,
even
yeah.
though like,
yeah.
their decisions and the way that they interact and stuff start to piss you off.
Right,
you know, you're like, God, just can you just be fucking normal? Can you just talk to each other like normal grown ups? You know, and. But, you know,
it was funny, though, the twist in that, though, the family stuff and you know, but again, like right there, and it goes all the way through all the work there, you know, at the core of it is grief.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, like every movie, dude.
Everything that I've made, the core is grief or dad issues.
Right.
And it's like, you know, or there's something that it's about. Like, Boy is a comedy about child abuse or child neglect. Hunt for the Wilder People is my film about the foster system in New Zealand, the foster care system, and about children being neglected again.
But right at the beginning, it's, you know, it's grief.
Yeah.
For the two characters in that movie, you know, all, not just because of the treatment in the foster care system of that kid, but also the one person that he liked dies almost immediately.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's Sam Neill's wife.
Yeah.
So they're just wandering through the wilderness.
Not knowing how to talk to each other because the glue, the one person that grounded them is gone.
And they're both grieving.
Yeah.
And why where does that come from? I understand the dad stuff, but the grief stuff, I mean.
I just find people fascinating and I find that, you know, we come from a, so Māori culture, right? When people die, we go through a long grieving process. It's a big deal.
And there's a tradition
a long
to it?
Time. Yeah, there's a tradition
what
to
is
it.
It?
Well, it's an open casket and people come from miles around to the tribal grounds.
Yeah.
And you sit with the body for a whole week and it's just you just sit there and you cry and you laugh and you tell stories about them. You eat and, yeah, and then people fight and people get drunk and people, you know. And you go through all of these stages of grief while you're sitting there. And it fascinates me that very few Western cultures do that. You know, in Ireland, I think they do that. You know, people sit in the
Jews
house and
do
stuff
the
like,
Shiva thing.
Yeah. But like this thing is like a, it can often be mayhem. You know, it's just like just where the shit goes down. People fighting over the coffin. People wanting to take the body to another tribal land to bury it there because he had ancestors from that place.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, a lot of fucking crazy
all of it
craziness.
Comes out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, my dad built his own tomb and like that was a big deal.
Yeah, did
it was a massive deal.
They put him in it?
Yeah, I put him in it.
Yeah.
And you know, you don't do that. You know, you're supposed to be buried with everyone else. And yeah, I was like, he didn't want to be buried with you guys.
What did the tomb look like?
It was like a concrete bunker and he had like a Dracula sort of sarcophagus thing and I said
really?
He was building it. I said, what are you doing? He said, oh, I'm building my sarcophagus. And I'm like, are you dying? He said, no, I'm just getting ready. He goes, I want to put some beds in here for you and your brothers. And I was like, fuck, I'm not, there's no way I'm being in here, I'm being put in here with you.
And when did he die?
He died in 2015. But it's just like, this is what I'm talking about, this like larger than life stories that which really amazing, like, which are great cinematic moments.
Yeah.
Is where I find my fascination with family.
Yeah.
And like, you know, because in families, there's heroes, villains, there's like twists and turns, there's plot twists, there's all sorts of, you know, there's ridiculous moments. He built his own, you know, that. What do you call that? A square that you put a coffin in. What's that called? Is there a sarcophagus?
Maybe. I mean, I think it's a sarcophagus.
Like I'm thinking about Dracula, you know, the big thing with a concrete top.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you move it across to get to the body.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think it is maybe a sarcophagus.
Anyway, he built that for himself.
When? How old are you?
This was like about two years before he died.
Oh, okay. So he was older. This was his project.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This is his little project. And,
what did he die of?
Heart attack.
Yeah.
And anyway.
You put him in there.
Anyway.
You put him in there.
The coffin didn't fit.
No. He made it wrong?
He made it too short.
So what'd you do, get a new coffin or just?
Sawed the ends off the coffin.
And he's in there.
He's in there.
How many siblings do you have?
He's in there with his motorbikes.
Yeah, you put the bikes in on top?
Yeah, but the door was too small.
For the bikes?
Yeah, so I had to dismantle a fucking Harley and a Triumph, reassemble them inside his tomb. And then seal the thing.
But I mean, I think the testament to whatever the dynamic was is that you needed to finish. You needed to make it work.
This guy left me with a DIY project that I wouldn't wish upon anyone.
Now,
I'm like, why don't you leave me some money? Why don't you leave me the bikes?
You got to go find it.
And they're like, I'm like, oh, great, these are my bikes. And Michael's like, no.
They're going in.
They're going inside too.
You could have just said, fuck it.
I could have just said, fuck it, kept those bikes and just despite them.
You didn't.
I don't want this guy haunting me.
Yeah. Like, how many siblings do you have?
Two younger brothers.
So were they all helping out with the...
No, they didn't help out.
No.
It was me and my uncle. And my two uncles pouring concrete and making a concrete slab to go over the top of his rectangle thing.
Yeah.
And then putting these fucking bikes back
together.
Did you
have the people
tomb.
Come? Did everyone come? And
well, it was like, it's not a thing to build your own tomb, it turns out. So like everyone was a big, you know, it was a big issue. You know, the whole community came and, after we put them in there, we sawed the ends off the fucking coffin, put the things in, like, covered it up and shit. And, like, then everyone came down with some rose petals to have a look inside.
Yeah.
And every single person was like, hey, shit, that's a pretty fucking good idea. I like this. I like a tomb. I'll make my own tomb. Who knows, mate, who's building tombs now? Maybe he just started the trend of tomb building.
Changed the whole culture.
Yeah. He just went against tradition. We were supposed to be buried together on a hill.
Yeah.
And he was like, I'm not being buried with those motherfuckers.
We wanted to be special.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I remember him telling me about it. And he said, I'm not going to be buried in here with you psychos. And he goes, well, are you sure? Because there's going to be a secret tunnel that only three people know about. Like, yeah, you know, he really was like, thought he was like an Egyptian, right. You know, fucking king. And he was like, yeah, I'm going to be buried in there with all my treasures. And I was like, a secret tunnel?
Yeah.
Like, that's already giving me anxiety, like that my ghost wouldn't even be able to get out of there. I'd be stuck in there with you.
So no secret tunnel. He didn't finish that part?
He didn't finish the tunnel.
Well, thank God. Well, at least maybe that's where you got your imagination.
I think so, because it was a larger-than-life character, and all those big, big stories from those times back in the 70s and 80s, and I grew up around that,
those
gangs and stuff, and like just crazy characters, and I think that's where I got that. Just that fascination with, like, you know, with people and what people are capable of, and not only, like, you know, like amazing achievements, but the damage people can do to each other.
Yeah,
and what they can do to themselves.
And you don't feel like you have the resolution around your relationship with that guy?
You know, I think I think when he died, I thought, I wish I, you know, is there anything I wish I'd said to him for some closure?
Yeah.
And I thought about it and I thought, actually, no, there's nothing I think I needed to say.
Yeah.
And, you know, well, the cool thing is, I think we got our resolution when I was finished Boy, and the crew had left town, and I was hanging out there, and I went up to see him, and our house is up on this hill, and it's like a hawk breeding ground.
Yeah.
And so hawks get hit on the road all the time. They come down to, you know, get a dead animal off the road, and they get hit by cars.
Yeah.
And so my dad started taking care of these injured hawks.
Yeah.
And so my my cousin dropped off this, you know, this wounded hawk to him, and he was building a cage for this thing.
Yeah.
I went up there as I finished Boy and everyone left, and so I just went up to say goodbye. And I saw that he was building his cage, so I just helped him out. And it was one of those great, again, another cinematic moment. We never said a word to each other, just built this big cage, put the chicken wire all around it, put some twigs in there for the animal to sit on, threw in some dead rabbits. And then, like, we nailed in the last nails, put the hawk in there, and we had closed the cage. And sort of just stood back and just looked at it, not saying anything. And then he just sort of just did that thing where he just puts his hand on my shoulder, just gives me like two taps. He goes, dut, dut.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this motherfucker loves me. I was like, that's our closure. That's it. I was like, oh, that's good. That's what I wanted. That's what I wanted for 33 years.
Two taps.
Just two taps on the shoulder. And the two taps can tell you a lot.
Yeah, for sure. Because you feel the weight of the moment.
Yeah.
Already.
It was like, you are basically mute. You can't express anything to me other than these two taps on the shoulder. And it was like the two tap, but the second tap was a tiny squeeze. You know,
yeah,
that one
there. Squeeze. Yeah. And that was
That's
good.
Meaningful.
That's
great.
For
people.
But you're like the opposite of that. You go. You talk.
I hug it out. Yeah. I talk. I kiss every person I get in their space. You know, I'm like an HR nightmare. I'm like just grabbing people all over town.
Well, what was your mom? Was your mom emotional?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. She wanted to talk everything out.
Oh, yeah. 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 Well, that's good. That's why Jews are good for that.
Yeah. 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 It's like, yeah. I feel guilty about something and I want to ruin your day by talking about it.
Yeah. Let's get it out there. Let's process it.
This is good for you for me to talk about me.
Yeah. Did your dad see Boy?
He saw Boy. Yep, he saw Boy. He was very proud of it. Oh, you know, and he knew it was about him. He knew all that. He was like, oh, my God. He was embarrassed about a few things. But he saw the humor in it all, you know. And
he's embarrassed, not mad.
If you put that fucking story about my bag of money in this fucking movie for everyone to see.
Yeah, but he was probably more worried that people would wonder where it was and he wouldn't be able to find
it. Yeah, exactly.
Why'd you tell anybody about that?
Oh, my God. He did these. This basically, I love talking about this stuff. He had this other crazy idea of farming lobster and sea urchins, which is our main food back down there.
Yeah.
And so, like, we live right on the ocean, and he got these diggers, and he was digging these trenches to put the seawater down into these big, long, big, you know, giant pits.
Yeah.
We're going to become like these ocean farming areas. Yeah. He was digging and digging and digging, and he dug up about 30 bodies.
Come on.
30 skeletons from, like, 600 or 700 years ago.
Was it a burial ground or a shipwreck or what?
Back in the day when people battled, where you died is where you were left.
Right.
And so down on the beaches were the areas for a lot of battles, a lot of fights. And that sort of like was like the way that Maori fought, going up to the beach and like have it out.
Yeah.
But when you died, in those days, you were untouched and the bodies would just sink into the sand and that was it. So he found fucking 30 of these fucking people.
Yeah.
And he was like, this is getting right in the way of my project of farming lobster and sea urchins.
Yeah.
So he chucked all the bones away. And and then he's like, he didn't believe in ghosts and shit, but he was like, I knew I'd done something wrong. I kept waking up, some fucking old woman was sitting on the end of my bed, like staring at me. And I was like, is that a ghost? He's like, I guess so. So anyway, he went and told the elders and stuff, and they got all the bones together and gave it a proper burial. And all the
really?
Ghosts, and the ghosts went away. But and, like, that was his mindset was like, these fucking old dead bodies are just in the way of my money-making scheme.
So the lobster farm never happened.
Never happened. These trenches just sat there.
He commits, though, that guy.
Oh, he commits. But you imagine that, digging up a human skull and being, no one can see. Fuck this shit and throwing it away.
How many are there?
Another one? Oh, 30?
That's crazy. But so when you did What We Do in the Shadows, I mean, like, did you feel like that was a big departure or like, you know, that was just for funny? You know, I mean, what?
It was a departure that was also, but again, that film is about grief and grief of like the loss of your own life and, you know.
And also the eternity of living forever.
Yeah, which is like a lot of people are like, I wish I could live forever. No, you don't, because humans are so lazy.
Yeah.
They could, like, that's why the great jokes in there is like, you know, I've read these books. There's like eight of them. And they're not very good at instruments because, like, when you live forever, you're going to put it off.
Yeah.
I'll learn to play violin next year.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of time. And so
the great character, though, was the really old vampire who didn't do anything.
Yeah. Yeah. It was one of my favorite jokes
but
in that.
But they all kind of respected him.
One of my favorite jokes in that took a long time to decide if we should put in the film was Deacon, the character who goes, and he says in the early parts of the film, he said, I don't know if you know this, but I was a Nazi vampire. And, you know, there's footage of him. Like, and he goes, they rounded up the vampires and made them become Nazis. And then he's like, and then what he says is, well, anyway, after that war was over, he goes, I don't know if you know this, but those Nazis, they lost that war.
Yeah.
You know? And we tested that in America, and people were like, what the fuck, man? Of course we know that, because we fucking kicked their asses.
Oh, you really?
Know,
yeah.
they thought it was in bad taste to put that joke in there.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, the point is, he's lived so long, he's seen 12 Holocausts.
Yeah, right.
He was like, I don't know if you know about that war. Those guys, they lost that war.
Sure.
You know, that was the kind of joke. It was like, if you live long enough, you see people repeating the same
shit.
Did
you leave it in?
We left it in.
Yeah.
We left it in. We thought, you know what, eventually you'll get it.
Yeah, and when I watch it, I didn't know what to expect because, you know, I'm not a horror guy. I'm not necessarily a vampire guy, but the conceit somehow or another, because it was so funny, it worked.
Yeah, like, I'm not a horror guy, and you know, I used to love watching vampire films, but the reason we made it was because vampires were so unpopular in film at the time. It was like vampires.
Nobody wanted
so
vampires.
Stupid. Yeah. I was like, oh yeah, vampires are actually pretty lame. Like when you think about like. They just sit around by themselves, dressing up how they used to dress. No real friends, talking about the same shit. Just like,
so you just put a bunch of them together.
They think they're very cool, but they're the least cool monsters there are.
You feel bad for them all.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very funny. What was your, did you have experience with the foster system? I mean, with the Hunt for the Wilder People? I mean.
I didn't, no, but there are a lot of sad stories in New Zealand about kids who went through the foster system.
That kid was great. You're very good at casting kids.
You know what? Everyone thinks I love working with kids. I don't.
Yeah.
It's very hard to work with kids.
But you do it all the time.
I do it all the time because, like, also, here's my secret.
Yeah.
Like, here's my secret.
Yeah.
I cast the kids.
Yeah.
I use them.
Yeah.
They get great performances. And then they're kind of ruined. And so I sort of toss them, get a new one. Is that some kind of weird, is that abuse? Because I find that they learn tricks. Kids, you look at Hollywood kids, they learn tricks in their early jobs and it just ruins their performances. Then they're just like, then they're actors.
After the first movie.
Actor kids.
Yeah.
But like non-actor kids are the best. They're so great, like natural. They don't know that there are tricks.
So usually you'd cast non-actor kids?
Always cast non-actors.
Where'd you find that kid in Wilder People?
He was, he just lived in Wellington and I ended up doing it. He just came in for some casting for a commercial I did and I thought he was fantastic and I just cast him on the spot for my film.
Yeah.
And he was amazing. He hated nature.
Yeah.
He was the kid. He was a city kid.
Right.
We'd go out into the woods and stuff and I'd say, okay, I want you to sit here on this log. And he's looked at the log and there'd be like a spider web on it. He's like, oh, I don't think my character would sit on that log.
And Sam had it seemed like he had a great time doing that.
Sam was fantastic. Yeah. It was great. It was good for him to come back to New Zealand, where he belongs.
Yeah,
and do some work.
I talked to him during the pandemic. It was a great conversation. He's kind of a beautifully cranky dude.
Yeah. Yeah. He's seen it all. I mean, he was in Hunt for the Red October.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He's been around. He was Damien in Omen 3.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, the older Damien.
The grown-up Damien. I always give him shit about that. I'm like, hey, when you were doing Omen 3, what was your character's motivation in that? When
to be the Antichrist.
And Event Horizon, the other great Sam Neill film, Event Horizon.
Yeah. Yeah, he's great. He's a great actor. Now, my late partner was a director, Lynn Shelton.
Yes.
I don't know if you've met each other somewhere, but she would try to get me to watch Ragnarok all the time. Because I'm not a Marvel guy. She's like, no, but Taika did it, and it's different, and you'll like it. I'm like, I don't know. And then I watched it, and I liked it. And I have no sense of Marvel. And do you feel that – was that a good experience for you?
It was a great experience. I didn't really have – I read a lot of comic books when I was a kid.
Sure.
Thor admittedly wasn't one of them. But, I was aware of Marvel and what they were doing, and I was enjoying – I loved Iron Man, and I was enjoying those films.
Yeah.
But it wasn't anything on my radar. It wasn't anything that I felt I was going to end up doing. I mean, look at my films,
Yeah.
Nothing says, oh, this is a trajectory to go and do Thor.
Yeah.
So – but I thought this is an opportunity to learn something, to learn about studio systems and how they make big films.
Yeah.
And also an opportunity to get some money because I just had my second kid.
Sure, we need money for the kids.
So I went and did it, and I had a great experience, and they were fantastic to me, and made a lot of great friends, on that project. So
yeah, how was it received?
Fantastic.
Yeah.
It was very, very well received.
So did you write the script?
No, I did a lot of passes on the script. And
okay.
And my process on the day is like make a lot of shit up and, and improvise or throw ideas at the actors.
Because I felt like it again had some humanity to it. I don't know how they usually are because I really don't watch a lot of them.
Mm.
But it seemed like there was that balance of comedy and self-awareness.
Yeah. Well, when you look at Thor, right? He's a He's a billionaire, trillionaire kid who yeah. lives in outer space. You yeah. know, he's like lives in a castle in outer space. He's so disconnected from the rest of the universe. And that's the thing that... But like everyone else, like it's very hard to relate to a character like that. But like everyone else, he wants to impress his dad.
And his dad dies in that one, right?
His dad dies in that one, and without him finally impressing him,
yeah.
you know, and he's like, and that's really the heart of the story.
Yeah,
that his dad died again. Before he got a chance to show him how good he could be.
And then the I guess the other one came later. You know, that one, like, I don't know, because I don't know Marvel movies, like, you know, in the second Thor, yeah, I guess some people were like the CGI was different or there was issues around certain things. I don't know what your experience was.
In what one?
In Love and Thunder.
Right, yeah.
But, you know, there was like Marvel freak out around it.
Yeah.
With the nerds. But for me, like, I don't have any concept of any of that. And when the black and white thing happened, I'm like, oh, this is an homage to George Méliès and The Man in the Moon.
Oh my God, amazing.
This is like, and this is like, Tyke is doing this on purpose, but I don't know what your intention was, but I was looking at it cinematically.
On the moon.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that? And right now, I'm like, oh yeah, I get that. Black and white on the moon.
Right.
Shit, I might as well give him that moon a face.
Yeah, right. And had the bullet go right into his eye.
Yeah.
But Jojo Rabbit, like, goes back to your some sort of fascination with the almost childishness of Nazis.
Yeah, that's right. And look, you know, we all love Schindler's List, and we all love those films.
Heavy.
But heavy.
Yeah, sure.
I could watch Schindler's List maybe once every 10 years, maybe five years.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, obviously the conversation needs to keep happening. When you keep talking about this, you know, this, like, and what it came from is, like, there was a Guardian poll that they did in America, and you could find out the stats. Someone else can find out the stats. It's easy to find out. But they asked people under 20, these questions, and I think like 57% of people under 20 had never heard of the Holocaust.
Yeah, it's
and like 65 had never heard of Auschwitz, and that was like 10 years ago.
Well, I had a line about the future maybe 20, 30 years ago where I'm like, it's going to get to the point where kids are going to be like, oh, wait, Hitler's the guy with the mustache, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And the whole thing when that war ended was never forget.
Yeah.
And we're forgetting. And so, like, we have to keep telling that story. We have to keep these, if people are like, oh, another Nazi movie.
Yeah.
Well, we have to keep doing it because clearly people are remembering. But we have to keep doing it in different ways and, like, pulling the audience in with humor, with lightness, and then showing them how ridiculous.
And kids. Again, you know, sort of gifted kids. But, like, having Hitler as an imaginary friend because you're so bought into the Nazi thing and the acceptance of the Nazi thing and wanting to be part of it and all that. And this kid, what is he, 10, 11?
Yeah. And also Hitler can only know what an 11-year-old knows. Because it comes from his brain.
Right. And to have a clown Hitler, I mean, that hasn't happened in a while.
No.
You know, not since the producers probably.
And some people were Nazi. Like, oh, in bad taste. I'm like, hang on. Someone was doing it in 1939.
Yeah, Chaplin.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so but it was different because it was the conception of the kid and the kid's own self-judgment and also having an absent father.
Yeah.
That was a mythological being in a way. So Hitler was the best thing he can conjure up.
Yeah.
And he was a sweet kid. Yeah, it was a delicate balance there, and it doesn't really...
It's really fascinating as well. You know, 9/11, a lot of kids don't know what that is. They know this thing called 9/11.
Right.
But there are kids who don't know what happened.
There's no collective sense of history anymore. You know, everything is happening all at once. So if no one's giving context to anything, you're only going to see clips of things.
Yeah.
You're not going to know what it is or what it represents or why it happened or how it happened or the policy that went involved and what you know, who's going to know any of that?
I guess it's for me growing up and seeing Platoon and being like, I don't know what this is. What is this Vietnam War?
Right, sure.
So it's like, you know, seeing clips from it and my memory of Vietnam, even though I wasn't even alive, is old, like, grainy footage of people running around and, like, you know, and, like, torpedoes and, like, you know, like the napalm and stuff. And,
yeah.
But I don't know, and I'm like, you know, I feel it's interesting. And even the Bosnian War.
Yeah.
You know, when that, like, that's the one that nobody knows about.
But
and
also,
that was the biggest, like, the biggest example of people being horrible to each other since World War II.
And they were neighbors.
And they were neighbors, yeah.
Well, I mean, it also, depending on where you grow up culturally, like I notice that even if I travel to Canada, that I get a tremendous amount of relief because the psychic cancer that is pervading America, they know about it, but it isn't their life.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of times what you know is relative to your personal history. And then the rest is sort of like, you know, you pick and choose.
Yeah.
Somebody contextualizes something.
That is interesting because, like, you know, especially like, I don't know what this is, but like, you know, around the world, there's this idea that like you must know about everything.
Yeah.
And you must have a comment, you must have an opinion and know about every single thing going on. I'm like, okay, well, how many of you know about the things that Māori have gone through in New Zealand?
Right.
How many of you know about, you know, the land wars in the 1800s and what we went through? How many of you know that it was illegal to, you know, to speak our language at school? How many of you know about what we lost? No one. You know, but you expected to jump on someone's side, you know, whenever something's on Instagram or something. Right. You know, it's like you need to be on the
– Right, when the global culture decides, when the momentum picks – when the algorithm that dictates, you know, what we're supposed to know is important decides collectively what is important, then all of a sudden everyone's up and – I live in – this is an Armenian neighborhood. They've gone through horrendous history. I'm not real clear on it, but I respect the fact that, like, all right, something bad happened.
Yeah. Asking minorities to care about other minorities is we should, but it's just a funny thing where it's like, you know, I understand a little bit like why some minorities, they go, oh, okay, you're making a big deal about that. What about us?
Well, yeah, but that's what you've taken upon yourself to tell your own stories, right? So, and that's what's interesting about the reservation dogs thing is that, you know, you understood that the experience of Indigenous people was common but different, and the perception of those people was limited at best, and that you had the power to tell the stories the way you wanted to and in a way that was authentic to your experience.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it makes such a fucking difference. I mean, I can't shut up about, like, you know, I'm the one who, when I told Sterling, I'm like, you got anything for me? I want to be part of this.
Awesome.
And he put me in it that third season. It was great. But to be on a set that's all Native and to see them, you know, have the freedom of mind and the freedom of creativity to do that and work together, you could feel the kind of elevation, the pride of having the opportunity and the ability to play on the big field, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It was fucking great, man. But this new movie, which I watched as well, it's so funny when I actually do my homework how I need to pride myself on it. By the way, I did all my research.
You
on
did. You're the only person who's ever done it.
Really?
Why? No, I got fucking one time someone when I was casting for something. I think I was casting for Jojo Rabbit, and someone said, "Oh, this actress, she's a massive." Their agent got in touch. She's a huge fan of your work. She really wants to meet, blah, blah, blah. And I went and had breakfast with her, and she said, so I've heard about your work, and I can't wait to see something.
Yeah. Well,
son of a bitch.
Some people come here, and they act like, you know, I really like the show. And then the ones that they name, I'm like, oh, you just listened to two last week, didn't you? You know.
My favorite one was the Kim Deal.
Oh, yeah, right? Yeah, I mean, I don't even know, but I know almost always I have – you know, a good conversation. And then, like, it goes away for me and my producer deals with it. Yeah. So he becomes my memory. Like, I literally, like, what would I talk about that? Because I'm in it.
Yeah.
But this one, again, Next Goal Wins. I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but it's another, you know, beautiful movie.
Grief.
Exactly. But you don't know it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the turn is kind of it's intense. And the story, you know, being that it's a true story, and I like all the sort of Maori stuff, you know, that the rituals of getting up to games and the sort of strange way that they handle a kind of structured ritual of competition, you know, with other teams. Because I imagine all that's real, right?
Yeah. Well, in New Zealand, like, here's the thing. I come from like a rugby playing nation, and I don't know that much about soccer, to be honest. But what I wanted to do was to make a film with Pacific Islanders on it, and like that's what my, you know, I just wanted to come back home, come back to the Pacific, and just put, you know, put brown people on screen again, and you know, and come back and it was just so nice to be in Hawaii with Samoans and Maori and like everyone together making this film about, and it's such a crazy true story too, like the idea of the shame of a team losing 31-0. And that's still the record for the biggest international loss in soccer. 31-0 to Australia.
Yeah.
That's like a goal every 3 minutes.
Yeah, it's crazy. But what's interesting is the kind of team spirit and the island pride, you know, kind of balanced with that guy that you use a few times. What's his name? The guy who plays the owner of the team or the...
Oh, yeah, yeah, Oscar Carly, yeah.
That his disposition was, it was really about the esteem of the kids, you know, over the idea of winning.
Yeah.
So it just became, you know, a tribal kind of... responsibility, a service.
Yeah.
So the kids have something to focus on, right? And that character kind of balances the whole thing all the way through.
Yeah, I think Oscar is actually probably the most important part of that.
Right.
In a way.
Yeah.
You know, he's trying to pull these two worlds together.
Yeah.
And keep them, you know, keep them from falling apart.
And you don't really know why Michael Fassbender's character makes a choice to that he did, and it sort of unfolds. But, you know, you do have a hard time empathizing with him for a while.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, there's a fascination and an obsession with making characters likable at the moment. You know, you've got to have a likable character. You know, look at, The Last Detail. Jack Nicholson's character is not a nice guy throughout the entire movie. He doesn't do one nice thing.
Yeah.
But he's the most watchable character, and I like him.
Well, that was interesting where you have the sort of rules and the job – you know, playing against the unavoidable empathy that they're both kind of having, and ultimately it doesn't really win out.
Yeah, when they're taking Randy to, you know, across the country, and it's just the perfect, you know. Yeah,
and they did everything they could for the kid.
They did, yeah.
But they still had to do their duty.
Yeah.
And then when they walk away from it, it's almost as if it just goes away.
Yeah, they're like, well, that was that one.
Right, exactly. But with yours, I mean, you had to figure out how to take a story, which is the underdog team, not an unusual story, but because it was a real story and it was your culture, that you know, you were able to infuse it with what really happened, but also with the nature of telling native stories.
Yeah, but also I had no interest in telling the exact story, the true story, because it's very... You know, I've changed a lot of things.
Yeah.
And I feel like if you want to see the real story, then watch the documentary. But even then, documentaries aren't real.
No.
Documentaries, they're edited to form a point of view.
Sure, it depends who's in charge and how much say the subject has.
Yeah, you could edit, you know, take a doc. You know, I was saying yesterday to someone, you could take Bowling for Columbine and re-edit it.
Yeah.
To have a completely different point of view.
Well, yeah, they might do that after the fascist win.
Yeah, they re-edit everything.
Yeah. This was a success story.
Yeah.
Well, so what?
So I gave myself permission changes. to focus on some, you know, relationship stuff, like with the coach and the Fafafine character Jaya.
Yeah,
you know, and making more of that relationship because, you know, you need somewhere for a character like Michael's character. You need somewhere for them to go. And for someone who's, let's just talk, you know, who's lost a child.
Yeah.
You know, had a great loss in his life. And then to meet someone.
Yes.
Who kind of in some ways, like, you know, is a surrogate.
Very different in that they're a trans person.
Yes. And I just thought, well, that's a great thing to focus on and not make a big deal out of it as well.
Right.
Like, let's not make a big deal out of the trans thing with the that cultural thing. Because, you know, there's a level of acceptance around that stuff, which has been around forever in the Pacific. You know, where like everyone in the West is just starting to have this conversation now. And they're trying to figure this out and understand it. And like, oh, we have to, there's certain things we have to say and all that.
And moralize about it. I mean, I wish it was more understanding it.
Yeah. Just like, and also just say, oh, that makes you happy.
But even
can we move on to something else that's more important?
Right. But it seems like even in, like, I'm sure a movie that is not looked favorably on by Native people, but in Little Big Man, that you know, there are, you know, trans characters, and it's just part of the fabric, the social fabric of the tribe.
Yeah, and it's accepted, and you just go, I think in a more Hollywood version of this, or you know, like by a different filmmaker, there'd be that big speech, you know, about someone saying, it's okay to be different, you know. Long, boring, stupid speech.
But that was not your intent. It was just to embrace the idea of tribal acceptance versus
and just show that this is what it is, and no one talks about it because everyone accepts it.
And then you have the coach who's got his own problems pushing back on it.
Yeah,
a bit,
a little bit. Yeah. And just because it's, and again, it's a character who deeply hates himself and feels guilty,
blames
himself for a lot of things, and then takes that out on everyone around him.
Right.
And it's like...
And I thought you wrote a line with that, too. That could have gotten even uglier.
Oh, right, with
his character, you know, in terms of taking it out on people.
Yeah.
Because you seem to have a really good sense of that. Because if you tip it too far, then you deny the possibility of empathy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If the guy turns into a real monster who doesn't have a change... Then, you know, what do you have? Then you have a 70s movie. But it's not necessarily a happy ending.
Yeah.
But you do feel that...
A 70s movie is a great way to think about things. I think everyone wants to be Hal Ashby, if they're honest. But like...
pretty great stuff.
Pretty great stuff. All different.
Yeah.
You know, and like, just when talking about 70s movies, I was thinking about Coming Home.
Oh, God.
And like, just like, you know, and that film... I think for me, even though it's not a comedy, is like there's just I keep thinking about it. My whole life I've been thinking about
me
that
too.
Film.
But oddly, I think about when Robert Carradine's character shot himself up with air and committed suicide when they couldn't get into the room.
Yes,
and
yes, fuck.
Right?
Yeah.
And then Bruce Dern
walking into the ocean.
Oh my God! Freaking,
but that intense scene when John Voight comes in and he's dealing with Jane Fonda and with Dern.
Yeah.
And Dern's got the gun and he's like just like he doesn't actually know why he's fucking doing this and all that and then they play what's the fucking it's the Tim Buckley song as he walks off into the water.
Stuff
and it's, but that films like that. Those 70s films, all the President's Men, like all the Hal Ashby films.
Yeah.
You know, those things have just, they're the things that stick with me. And I think a lot of people, like, when they ask me, like, oh, what's your influences? Must be like comedies. Very few comedies. A lot of them are just good dramas, the great film Spirit of the Beehive, which is another really great Spanish film that I've always gone back to. But, like, you know, the early Malick films, of course. But Coming Home is a great character-driven piece where you're just seeing people just bumping into each other for a couple of hours.
I just watched, it was interesting because, you know, I've watched The French Connection several times, but there was another movie done by, I think, someone involved with The French Connection, I don't remember the director's name, called The Seven Ups with Roy Scheider. It's a cop movie, but... It was one of these I thought, like, why doesn't anyone ever talk about this movie? Because it's of the same time. It's shot like The French Connection. And it's got one of those endings where there's closure, but it's gnarly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
They just had balls to do that.
But also, those fucking films, those characters are not likable.
No. Yeah.
Most of them are fucking racist white cops.
Sure.
You know, beating up black people and then they just go and do their thing, and like you're like, well, that's a cool character.
Yeah, well, yeah, Popeye Doyle was like one of the most menacing fucking characters. He shot an FBI guy and didn't even think twice about it. Remember, he accidentally kills that guy when they're chasing down the Frenchman, and then he's just like, fuck him, and then he keeps looking. Yeah. So, but this one seemed to be even though you did it a few years ago, kind of a return to, you know, what you're good at and what you're comfortable with, not that you're not good at everything, but is the next movie going to be a big departure or what? What are you thinking?
The next one, what I'm trying to do in the next one is a film, an adaptation of a Kazuo Ishiguro book called Clara and the Sun.
Okay.
It's a really great book, and it's about an AA for that people. In the near future, people have these artificial friends who, you know, and the way I want to do that is that it's not like having Siri or like a robot that's connected to the internet.
Or her.
It's just basically a lifelike robot who hangs around with you, who doesn't know very much.
Are you going to play it?
I'll be in there. Don't you worry. What kind of question is that? But I like the idea that in the future, it's just having company. Is what humans want. And you don't want a robot who's super smart or can tell you what the weather's like in Japan. It's just a person to hang out with you who doesn't know much and might be good at listening.
Oh, that's funny. That sounds like
it's about this, like companion
sad
robots.
Sad and funny.
Sad and funny. But that's underneath it all, the idea is, what I'm fascinated by is, like, is the idea that love is a program. Because, you know, if you've gone to enough couples counseling,
sure,
you know, they'll tell you, you can program yourself to love someone.
Make different choices.
You can, yeah. You can convince yourself that you're in love with someone.
Yeah.
You can tell someone, I love you, 50 times a day. Eventually your brain will give up and go, okay.
Well, I think there's love. It's a broad spectrum of what love means, right?
Yeah.
I mean, being in love is, you know, in my experience being that, and maybe yours, if depending on what kind of child you come from, a childhood you come from, when you're in love, you're probably smart not to trust it because it's going to get chaotic.
Yeah.
And it's going to get messy. It's going to be really exciting for a while, but then untenable.
Yeah. But that's basically all relationships until
you program yourself.
Until you program yourself, until you give up and just sit with it.
Right.
Yeah, no, I'm a little bit more hopeful than that with love. But it is an idea that I thought about. If the human brain is basically a computer that can be programmed to love, then what's the difference with a robot?
Yeah.
With AI? What's the, you know?
Yeah. How far along are you in it?
I'm writing it.
Okay. Well, it's great talking to you, man.
I love you, brother.
I love you, too. I really, I think you are...
Man, we went through everything. I haven't told my therapist half this shit.
But I think you're a real genius guy in that, you know, in terms of being a director who truly has a point of view and a voice that is, you know, distinguishable. And it goes through all the work, and that's an amazing thing. Congrats.
I love you, man.
Love you
Thank
too.
Thank you, brother.
There you go. Genius. Next Goal Wins is playing now in theaters. Hang out for a minute, people. Okay, so a couple things. Be careful this Thanksgiving. I'll talk to you day of. I got my optometrist on. Dr. Elliot Kane, who's primarily a trumpeter, but he's mostly an optometrist, but he's a jazz trumpet player. It doesn't matter. And also, if you have some time this week, you might want to go listen to episode 702 with Rob Reiner. You can hear that for free right now on whatever podcast app you're using and listen to Rob tell stories about his friend Albert.
It's funny, your father, you just said you were the brooding kid.
I was.
But, but you talk to your father, and within seconds, it'll be my son's friend, Albert.
Yes.
The funniest guy I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, he was the funniest. And Albert was a prodigy. At age 16.
A comedy prodigy?
Yes, a comedy prodigy. At age 16, he could make not just adults laugh, but professional, world-class professional comedians.
Yeah.
My dad, Mel, he'd make them laugh at age 16. It was an amazing thing.
And you guys have been friends since you were what?
Since we were 16.
That's crazy, right?
Yeah,
and
you're
still friends now?
Yeah.
He came up to me last night, you know, because he won't come on the show.
He won't?
No.
Why?
Because I don't know. You tell me.
You know why? Because you don't pay him. That's why.
Really? Is that it?
I think that's it.
It's not because he doesn't like to talk about himself?
No. He's happy to talk. He just doesn't want to waste all that good comedy.
You know? What do you think it would take?
I don't know.
And $500?
I don't know. But he's brilliant.
Yeah. For no particular reason at all, go back and check out episode 702 for Rob's stories about his friend Albert, as in Albert Brooks. No reason. And you can also get every episode of WTF ad-free when you sign up for WTF Plus. Just go to the link in the episode description and or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. Here's some guitar. I was trying to do a thing.
rumor lives. Monkey and LaFonda, cat angels everywhere. That was a hard one, but I think I could polish it up.